Ladies and gentlemen, what follows is a United Nations radio program. We begin it with a parlor game. It's called Find the Definition. I give you a word, you define it. You, sir, you first. Define pseudonymously.
Too hard. Give up.
Well, here's another then. Flower.
Flower? Has petals. Feeds on manure if it can. Either grows or dies, can get women gooey-eyed, sniffs pleasant or dreadful, pollinates on occasions.
Well, that'll do. Next, refugee.
Different from other people, lives in camps, has had to leave his country, has no nationality, wants to get a passport, right?
Well, not quite. There are grains of truth in that heap of words, but the heap itself is formless, incomplete, and so wrong. Try again.
May I try this one?
Go ahead, sir.
A refugee. He is a man like other men. A complex being of blood and flesh and bone, of hopes and needs and wants and fears, seeking what all men seek, a touch of happiness and the fullness of a meaning in one's life, who asks what all men ask for. The right to labor, to love, to belong. But, unlike most other men, he is one who has seen this right once his, drown in the inhuman vortex of some human violence, or seen it fade away and lose itself in the stardust of some incandescent ideal. A refugee is a man who stands beyond the borders of his birth, and in most cases he stands empty-handed and alone. With the world he once knew in ruins behind him, he bends his eyes now toward new horizons of help and hope, asking for a new heart, a new start for an old.
United Nations Radio presents New Hearts for Old. 11 years ago, the General Assembly of the United Nations proclaimed a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This year, that declaration has a marked and specific application to large groups of people in all parts of the earth who have been defined as refugees. The narrator is Charlton Heston.
Think of a building that you've grown to love. A private home, a conservatorium, possibly a museum, preserving architectural beauty, art, and a whole way of life. It has many thousands of bricks and a few score paintings. Now imagine that it's been destroyed. How do you recreate it? You can rebuild the bricks, but that isn't the museum. You'll have a hard time to replace not so much the art of the oils, but the emotional life that's been fastened up in them, infused through the building as a whole. An emotional life woven of the thousand intangibles that had been caught up in the bolts of canvas. A charged and complex emotional existence. Hate and love, purity, lust, nobility, anger, lechery, and tenderness. We've tended to think of the protection and preservation of human life too much, perhaps, in terms of the physical aspects. We've become obsessed with the desire to avoid physical destruction, and our pities too often focus too sharply on the plight of the individual living in the violent atmosphere of war, of the sentry on duty in a quiet night who doesn't hear the heavy grunting of the machine gun that sends its 2-ounce drums of steel and lead to crash against his ribcage, making knots of nerves and tendons, knifing splintered strands of bone and lung into a leaping, dying heart. Now, this is a situation that shocks us, the loss of human life. But there are other ruthless deprivations that the human spirit can suffer that are just as shocking. And yet, when these occur, we do not cry out against them with the same explosive force. Have you ever tried to picture an existence that knows nothing of Article 23 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Everyone has the right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment.
It isn't, of course, only refugees who've been denied the right to work. Have you ever looked closely at the face and eyes of an unemployed man? Have you sensed through the eyes the reiterant pulsings somewhere in the back of the brain?
Slack muscle, gray world, useless knowledge, limpness of existence, no joy and tiredness after exertion, gray world, no proof of usefulness, no reward of wages for effort, limpness of existence.
No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon his honor and reputation.
Article 12 of the Declaration. Have you ever watched closely the behavior of a man living in one room of a hut with many rooms and with strangers living in that room with him? Have you watched his eyes and movements and through them felt the pulsings somewhere in the spirit?
Limpness of existence. No home. Hard to get privacy. I must make some place mine. Not a whole room because others are here. I will find a shelf and make it mine. If there is no shelf, I will put my things on a chair and make it mine. If there is no chair, I will heap my things neatly on a corner of the floor, and that will make the corner mine. Hard to find privacy. Grey world. If there is no floor, I will put my things in my pocket, and my hand will reach in often, secretly, and feel that the pocket is my home. With the two photographs, the knife, the coffee tin, the two-year-old letter. Grey world. A small place that is mine. Barrenness.
Everyone has the right to a nationality. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his nationality, nor denied the right to change his nationality.
Article 15 of the Declaration. Have you ever looked really closely at the face of an outcast?
I can choose nothing. I have no rule over myself. Who can include me when he says, "These are my people, I speak for my people"?
Article 16.
Men and women of full age, without any limitation due to race, nationality, or religion, have the right to marry and to found a family.
Limpness of existence, sensation of barrenness, gray world.
As we move through other phrases from the Universal Declaration, watch the face carefully.
Everyone has the right to own property, alone as well as in association with others.
Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression.
Everyone has the right to rest and leisure,
including reasonable limitation of working hours
and periodic holidays
with pay.
Everyone has the right freely to participate in the cultural life of the community.
Shall we go on reading what must sound to a refugee's ears as something close to mockery? In the specific application of human rights to the cold, confined, camp or barracks existence of the refugee, we should certainly turn to Article 29.
Everyone has duties to the community, in which alone the free and full development of his personality is possible.
This very likely would be the greatest gift we could present to the refugee. Duties to the community, ties of the family, of work, social gatherings, of emotional fulfillment in music and friendships and possessions, the multiple bonds essential for the full and free development of a personality. If we allow these ties, these moorings, to be cut through, shorn away, not replaced, then we allow destructive blasts to crash against the ribcage of the mind, knotting up desires and needs, knifing splintered strands of hope and longing into a despairing, dying spirit. In 1957, three young Englishmen, Christopher Chataway, Colin Jones, and Trevor Philpott, toured through Europe, the Middle East, and the Far East to experience at first hand the world refugee problem. The result was an article called Wanted, a World Refugee Year. The response to it was enormous, and the suggestion of the authors that the idea should be put before the United Nations General Assembly was carried out. The first resolution that was adopted on December 5th, 1958, summarizes the twofold purpose of World Refugee Year.
To focus interest on the refugee problem and to encourage additional financial contributions from governments, voluntary agencies, and the general public.
Keeping in mind what must be rebuilt into the existence of a refugee, we shall listen to the conversation of three refugee families, chosen arbitrarily from the people who've been resettled in Australia, England, and the United States. This, first, is the Australian family, interviewed in Sydney by Mr. Keith Smith.
2 minutes ago, I walked into a villa in Pennant Hills, a narrow suburb of Sydney. Now, if I'd been just passing, I would have stopped to look at the house, I'm sure I would have, because it was a different kind of house. Every bit of it was obviously handmade. With me are the tenants, Mr. and Mrs. Conrad Peels, two of the 1.5 million migrants who have now become an important part of Australia. And here is their story. Mrs. Peels, let's start off this way. Tell me, when did you and your husband first come to Australia?
We came in 1948 from Germany, and we came as single because the first transports to Australia were for single people. And then when we came out, the first week we were married. In the migrant center in Bathurst.
I see. And did you both bring trades or professions to Australia with you?
Yes. I was a professional singer. Of course, I couldn't do it first here. But I worked like domestic, and I learned the English language.
Mr. Peels, tell us, how much money did you bring to Australia with you for yourself and your future wife?
We were one from the lucky migrants who had the money with us. We had one real Australian pound bought in black market in Germany.
That's not a lot of money by anybody's standards. What did you do with your £1 when you landed in Australia?
Oh, we were quite hungry to get some fruit and sweets because they were always short like a fat stew in Germany.
Oh, yes. And where did you... And when you landed in Australia, where did you go? To a hostel, no doubt,
We went to Bathurst, the migrant center. And my husband was very lucky enough. He got a job as sandwriter the first week we arrived. But I couldn't get straight away a job. And later on, I was on domestic duties and never lost my humor. When sometimes the manager of the camp asked me how I felt, I said, oh, I feel very wonderful. I feel like just on the stage. I think it's very wise not to lose the humor. The humor is the most important thing in the life.
They came alone, of course, and with the money only for a few bags of sweets and fruit. The typical barren beginning, the initial working capital, a sense of humor, and the roof of a small room in a hut. The second of these refugee families was taken to England. Audrey Russell of the BBC talks with the Zuha family in Hertfordshire, just north of London.
Let me first introduce the father of the family. It's Mr. Stefan Zuha, who now works in a flour mill in Hitchin. Previously, before the war, he was a hotel proprietor. Briefly, his history is this. In 1941, he was put in prison for working against the Germans. His wife died just before the end of the war, but even at the end of the war, it wasn't the end of his sufferings, because after a number of complications and great difficulties, eventually he moved to Trieste, where he was given refugee status. And he spent 3 years with his son and his daughter-in-law, who I'm happy to say are here, also sitting at the microphone, 3 years in the Opachina refugee camp. Well, now, Mr. Zuha, this is the moment when you take over the story. Can you tell us, when did you first apply to come to Britain?
I have written in the newspaper that British Parliament has got 700 visa to come in this country. And I had had application to British Council for Aid to Refugees, and they promised me to do all they can. Mm-hmm. And after fortnight, I got the answer, and in 9 months' time, we are here in this country.
Well, that wasn't too long a wait, was it, compared to some people? But you were 3 years in the camp. Now, let's have a word with your son, Mr. Carlo. What was the camp like?
Every camp is the same, I think. That's my opinion. I don't know. When we got in camp, that was terrible. First impression was, I think, terrible for me, because I was used to live in a nice house and nice with nice rooms and so on. And where we got in big camp with about 800 or 900 people crowded in barracks, which was about 20 yards long and 2-3 yards wide, used to live about 20 to 30 people inside. So I wasn't very pleased, but we just had to stay till we got here in England.
Well, now, what happened to you when you first got to Britain?
When we first got into Britain, we had everything. We must thank that to British Aid for Refugees, because they provide us with everything from the beginning. We had flat in the house, which was waiting ready for us. We just moved in. And in house itself, everything was furnished. Even food for 2 weeks was prepared.
Again, the barren background of camp existence, where even hope can be a dangerous emotion. The third refugee family was found in New York. UN radio correspondent Jeff Sparks meets the Shanoffs.
And would you kindly tell us your name?
My name is Walter Shanoff.
Walter Shanoff, S-H-A-N-O-V?
That's correct.
In the course of the Second World War, Mr. Shanoff, along with thousands of others, found himself in a camp.
This was a refugee camp?
That's correct.
And who ran the camp?
Well, at that time, during the war, of course, the Nazis ran the camps.
Oh, I see. First, you were actually a Nazi prisoner.
Well, it was a so-called labor camps.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not... I was like a forced labor work for German industry.
Yes. And that is a part of the story that I imagine you'd sooner forget.
Well, I hope so.
A few minutes later, Mr. Walter Shanoff made a rather profound comment.
Since 1945 to 1951, it's my case, no matter how I live in the camp, but I still enjoyed some sort of help through the United Nations and United States and other countries. I think that was a most important human relationship since centuries, because I don't think that would be possible to happen 100 years ago.
To foster this relationship is one of the prime purposes of World Refugee Year. No one must be forgotten, and no one must be allowed to live with the thought that he's forgotten. It's not only material help that refugees need. They're in urgent need of a new heart. The major part of refugee endeavor ends with the landing of the refugee on another shore where he can work for his own resettlement. The greatest barrier that the refugee faces is that of the border of nations. Before he's accepted, he's helpless. After acceptance, he can help to help himself. For many, of course, the main barrier at this stage is language. This is Mrs. Peules in Sydney.
Of course, everything was new to you at the time, even those country towns you mentioned.
Yes, it was very new, and I would never forget one day when we were in Orange and some of the ladies wanted to talk to me. I couldn't understand a word because I talked too fast. And my English wasn't good enough to understand.
Language is the barrier to friendships. For Mr. Peules, language is a barrier to work.
Mr. Peules, was it very hard to apply you a particular trade in Australia among strangers who spoke a different tongue?
The English language wasn't, well, from beginning was hard, but we learned quite hard, and after 1 year, we were quite able to speak enough and understand enough English for everyday use.
Must have been some rather odd words, some of those odd words Australian tradesmen use.
There were quite a few.
We won't go into those.
Inevitably, the new warmth comes to the refugee. He has friends again, Mrs. Shannon.
I met friends very quickly, and if people, they are so friendly in here in United States, I should say, the old friends I have, and they helped me a lot. I remember the case when I was studying for my citizenship. My friends in the hospital when I worked, they was telling me all the history of the United States, was helping me with all kind of questions, and I am very, very grateful.
And this is Mrs. Zohar in England.
Now, Mrs. Zohar, I think I should have said earlier on that there's been an addition to the family. Did you have her in the hospital?
Yes, I did have a little girl in hospital, in Hitchin Maternity Hospital. And I was very pleased there, and they was looking very good after me.
And in Sydney, Australia?
We were only for 8 months in the migrant center when we came one day to Sydney, and we were invited in Pennant Hills to a friend's place. And we liked Pennant Hills so much that we always dreamt to get a nice block of land in Pennant Hills.
Did you have the money behind you by that time to purchase the block of land?
Really not. We had only half of it. But we have a very nice Australian friend who said, if you are in difficulties, we will always help you. So she lent the money to us, and we could get the block of land, which we liked very much.
A refugee needs the help of friends, but he also needs the emotional satisfaction of having them in his life. It's interesting, for instance, to hear the reaction of Mrs. Peules at the moment when she received a telegram stating that her 80-year-old mother had been given permission to come to Australia. Mother and daughter had not seen each other for 16 years.
What an exciting moment. What did you do?
I didn't know what to do because it was too much for me, and I thought I had to run to the next door people.
The next door people. In honor of her mother's arrival, Mrs. Peules gave a vocal recital at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music, her first opportunity in years as a professional singer to sing in public. There's newfound warmth in Hertfordshire, England, too.
You know many English people?
Oh, yes, we do. Especially I.
Uh-huh. Why especially Father?
I don't know. I always love when my father's come home. He always said, oh, I have this, you know, our gossips are. I have this or that. I says, how you know this? And he says, oh, I know this old woman, you know, around.
Does he?
The dignity of work, the reward of wages, the contribution to a community. These expand the dimensions of a new heart. In the bleakness of a DP camp, Walter Shanov studied electronics. Then he could see no way of putting his knowledge to use.
I learned a great deal about my subject, my favorite subject.
Now, your work today is electronics?
Yes. I am a senior electronic technician.
So you are professionally contented?
Yes. I am building prototypes. I am helped to design and build the old prototype.
In other words, you are engaged today in a work that you enjoy doing.
Oh, yes, I love it very much. It's fascinating field, and it's very interesting.
Happiness in work provides many of the mooring ropes that meet the urgent human need to belong somewhere, to belong.
Are you going to assume British nationality if you can?
Oh, yes, we are going after full 5 years' time. When we're staying here in England, we have a right to apply for.
Yes, and I think it's 7 years, isn't it, Mr. Zohar?
So I am told.
Mm-hmm. So you've got just another 2 years.
Duties to the community, eagerly embraced, even the privilege of paying tax.
When I came in this country, I didn't have a penny. As a matter of fact, travelers aid owed me, I borrowed from travelers aid, $2 to pay for taxi.
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
What was your feeling when you made out your first income tax payment?
Income tax? Well, I consider that it was a very good feeling.
And the Peules family, too, wanting to be a part of a society. Keith Smith asked them...
You and your wife are naturalized, Mr. Peules?
Yes, we are naturalized 3 years ago.
Well, you belong to us, and frankly, Australia belongs to you today, doesn't it?
Yes, and we are quite happy to be here and to feel that we belong somewhere.
For everyone, but for the refugee in particular, only the weaving of these emotional ties can lead to contentment. Jeff Sparks remarked to the Chanoff family.
Do you think that Shakespeare was right when he said, "My crown is called content, kings can have no more"?
Well, maybe he was right.
What do you think, Mr. Chanoff?
Yeah, I think so.
And Audrey Russell observed in England.
They've settled down, they all got jobs, and as far as I can see, largely through their own efforts and their initiative and their courage, they've made good here. And they're well established in the community.
Those were three of the great many thousands of families that have successfully been resettled. But the energies that have constructed the impetus of World Refugee Year are concerned with the vast numbers of people whose world is still a gray one. This huge task has been outlined by the Director of Information for World Refugee Year. For a statement from Mr. Duckworth Barker, we're taking you across to the European headquarters of the United Nations in Geneva.
You have just heard a number of people who have known the agony of being refugees. They have told you how lives can be remade if help is forthcoming at the critical moment. These were the stories of quite ordinary people. You would see little to distinguish them from their neighbors. And this is the real lesson they can teach us for World Refugee Year. Men and women who have lived as homeless outcasts for years can and must be helped to take a normal part in our society again. This is something we can do for them. But they or their children may have some contribution of rare value to make to us. In our time, we have seen refugees like the scientists Einstein and Fermi, the musician Toscanini, the writer Thomas Mann, and the architect Gropius. Their presence, even for a few years in America, will leave its mark there. You will have noticed that the people who spoke on this program, like those eminent refugees, came from Europe. But the Europeans form only a part of that great mass of sufferers whom World Refugee Year was designed by the United Nations to help. Here in Geneva, in the UN Secretariat for World Refugee Year, we are in touch with many other groups. There are over 1 million Arab refugees from Palestine in the Middle East who are cared for by the UN organ known as UNRWA. In Hong Kong, there are about the same number of Chinese refugees. For these huge groups, no permanent solution can be found until a political understanding has been reached. World Refugee Year is a non-political movement, and in their case it can only provide funds to make their life rather more bearable. For thousands of others, like those you heard on this program, it can mean the beginning of a new life. With 62 countries actively participating in the year, first results have been encouraging. One small state, New Zealand, reached its year-long target of funds to be raised in a matter of days and has gone on to higher goals. But we cannot yet speak of World Refugee Year as a success. Still more help will be required from governments, voluntary organizations, and individuals. Our thoughts today are on human rights. World Refugee Year is almost half over. These contemporaries of ours need one very elementary right which does not even appear in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a friend.
That was New Hearts for Old, a feature on human rights and the World Refugee Year. The program was narrated by Charlton Heston. New Hearts for Old was written and produced by the international staff of United Nations Radio in New York.